Hi, everyone, and welcome to this week's EHS podcast for the week ending March 6th. My name is Alan Nguyen.
And I'm Allison Granke.
And we'll be bringing you the latest news in environmental health and safety.
So an exciting new roundtable was launched this week, bringing together a large group of U.S. beef value chain participants in what's being called the USRSB, which is short for the U.S. Roundtable for Sustainable Beef. Founding members of the new initiative include Cargill Meat Solutions, McDonald's, Tyson Foods, Walmart, and the World Wildlife Fund, as well as several cattlemen associations and others. So in total, there are 43 producers, processors, retailers, food service operators, packers, allied industry, and non-governmental organizations. The members aim to identify sustainability indicators, establish verification methodologies, and generate field project data to test and confirm sustainability concepts with the hope that this data can be used throughout the U.S. They'll be using the definition of sustainable beef that was recently released by the Global Roundtable for Sustainable Beef, also known as the GRSB. So there are five principles and criteria for global sustainable beef as laid out by the GRSB. So those include producing beef in a manner that identifies and manages natural resources responsibly while still maintaining or enhancing the health of ecosystems. Number two, protecting and respecting human rights. Three, respecting and managing animals to ensure their health and welfare. Four, ensuring the safety and quality of beef products and using information sharing systems that promote beef sustainability. And then finally, number five, encouraging innovation, so optimizing production, reducing waste, and adding to economic viability. As one of the founding members of the U.S. Roundtable and the Global Table as well, McDonald's is an interesting example here, as the company has been taking a lot of strides independently towards transparency about their environmental impacts and sustainability goals. McDonald's website stated that they aim to begin purchasing verified sustainable beef in 2016. They've been working with the Global Roundtable for Sustainable Beef since 2011, and their website outlines the results of their 2013 carbon footprint calculation, for which they took a life cycle analysis approach that extended from farm to fork across their worldwide supply chain of restaurants. And according to McDonald's, the results of these calculations showed that 70% of their greenhouse gas emissions are from their sustainability chain. And of those, around 40% are related to beef. So it will definitely be interesting to see what this U.S. roundtable might be able to accomplish in the coming year or so. There are some skeptics who believe that these types of roundtables are sort of attempting to greenwash beef production and that the principles lack the specific measurable performance standards that are needed. So hopefully the roundtable will prove them wrong and will be able to take some real measurable steps to promoting sustainability within food industry supply chains. And if you'd like to learn more about the roundtable, you can check out the link in the resources section of this podcast. Membership will be open to additional founding members until June 1st of this year. And Alan, I believe you have a story for us about NIOSH and their new training program.
Yeah, so a new free web-based training released by the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, also known as NIOSH, will help emergency responders and their managers cope better with the demands of emergency operations when deployed to a disaster site. The 30-minute training program, labeled Interim NIOSH Training for Emergency Responders, Reducing Risks Associated with Long Work Hours, provides strategies to reduce health and safety risks that are linked to working long hours during the daytime. Long work hours coupled with the high physical and emotional strain associated with emergency response and recovery operations can prevent responders from getting enough sleep. Insufficient sleep puts responders and those around them at risk for fatigue-related mistakes that can lead to injuries and death. NIOSH Director John Howard stressed the importance of managing adequate sleep cycles for those working long hours, stating that, and I quote, "Workers and their managers across many sectors, healthcare, public safety, utilities, construction, humanitarian aid, and cleanup services, need to address the importance of sleep and plan for it like other critical logistical items to carry out operations such as having enough water, food, and supplies. The training is an important resource to promote the health resilience among those who are on front lines of a natural or man-made disaster," end quote. The training is designed to increase knowledge and promote better personal behaviors and workplace systems that will reduce the risk associated with working long hours. The training follows the following topics: dangers of working while sleepy and fatigued, basic information about sleep and fatigue, personal factors that could lead to higher health and safety risk, better work schedule design and other management strategies, signs and synopsis, fatigue and response workers, tips for improving sleep at night and alertness on the job, preventing fatigue and strain to muscle joints, preventing fatigue from strain to muscle and joints, and protecting from fatigue due to excessive heat. If you're interested in learning more about the training program, we've provided a link in the description of this podcast. And Allison, I believe you have a story for us about truck drivers not buckling up.
So this week, the CDC released a new report calling attention to large truck crashes in the United States. There are about 2.6 million workers driving large trucks in the U.S., large trucks being defined as those that weigh over 10,000 pounds. The report states that a total of 317,000 crashes involving large trucks were reported to police in the United States during 2012. The estimated cost of these truck and bus crashes that year was $99 billion. The report also states that more than one in three truck drivers have had a serious truck crash during their career. There are lots of other staggering statistics in the report, but one particular finding really stood out. It turns out many long-haul truck drivers are not wearing seatbelts. The report included data from the CDC's National Survey of U.S. Long-Haul Truck Driver Health and Injury, and their survey findings show that an estimated 14% of long-haul truck drivers reported not using a seatbelt on every trip. This is despite the fact that using a seatbelt is the single most effective intervention to prevent injury or death in vehicle crashes. So in 2012, more than one in three truck drivers who died in crashes were found to have not been wearing a seatbelt. And it's estimated that simply buckling up could have prevented up to 40% of those deaths. Now, it's true that seatbelts can sometimes be uncomfortable, particularly for long trips, but with the potential consequences being so high, that seems like it might be a small price to pay. The CDC is encouraging employers to help improve truck driver safety and increase seatbelt use among truck drivers by implementing strong company safety programs and policies. Not wearing a seatbelt is considered one of the three big risks to truck driver safety. The other two are drowsy driving and distracted driving. So employers can act proactively in these areas as well by ensuring that truck driver schedules allow for adequate rest and by implementing further safety programs that ban text messaging or the use of handheld cell phones while driving. For more information on this topic, you can check out the resources section of this podcast where we've included a link to CDC's Vital Signs report on truck driver safety. And Alan, you've got a story coming out of the Canadian railway industry.
Yeah, so the federal government recently introduced legislation that will enhance railway safety and increase accountability among the railway industry and crude oil shippers. The new Safe and Accountable Rail Act proposes amendments to Canada's Transportation Act and Railway Safety Act. Changes include a new liability and compensation regime for federally regulated railways, including minimum insurance requirements, a compensation fund financed by levies on crude oil shippers, increased information sharing provisions, and stronger oversight powers for the Minister and Transportation Canada's inspectors. The new liability and compensation regime will consist with those the government has introduced for other modes of transport, such as marine tankers and oil pipelines. It is based on, quote, polluter pays principles and makes railways and shippers responsible for costs and accidents, protecting taxpayers and communities by ensuring that adequate resources are available for compensation if accidents were to occur. Proposed amendments to the Railway Safety Act will broaden the powers of the minister and inspectors to order railway companies and others to take specific measures or stop any activity deemed necessary for safe railway operations. The proposed amendments will also create new regulation-making powers requiring railway companies to share information with municipalities. These changes are part of the government's commitment to strengthen oversight and increase collaboration between communities and the railway industry, addressing issues raised in the Transportation Safety Board's final report on Quebec's Lac-Mégantic derailment, as well as concerns of the Federation of Canadian Municipalities. Minister of Transport Lisa Ryatt also announced the new Railway Safety Management System regulations. SMS regulations require companies to develop and implement a new formal framework that integrates safety into their day-to-day operations. The new regulations will help address recommendations made in the November 2013 Auditor General's report and will reflect over 10 years of lessons learned in providing oversight of railway management systems. And as always, if you'd like to learn more about this story or any of the other stories that we covered in this podcast, be sure to check out the resource links. And that concludes this week's EHS podcast. As always, thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next week.